Today we're going to cover lectures 31, 32, and 33, and this will be a derivation of the fact that the heat capacity for metals has a component that goes like T. If you remember, we already talked about the heat capacity for non-metal crystals, and here's a graph of the heat capacity vertically versus temperature cubed horizontally, and the fact that you have a straight line tells you that the heat capacity CV goes like T cubed for non-metallic crystals, and we showed that that was due to the phonons. That's also called the lattice heat capacity or the vibrational heat capacity. That was Debye's correction to the Einstein formula. First, we looked at the Einstein model, particle in a cage, and we found that the heat capacity CV went like the exponential to the minus 1 over T. That didn't match experiment. Debye's model does a very good job of matching an experiment for non-metals. But we had a homework assignment where I showed you that the heat capacity for metals has a component that goes linearly like T. And now we want to derive that. Okay, so switching to lecture 31. This is a graph that I showed you last time, except I transposed the axes, and so I have the energy running vertically, and it's usually presented this way because I guess it's easier to imagine the states represented by the dots in here filling up the area under the curve. This is the G of E, the D of E, density of states curve. I call it the G of E because in this lecture that is going to be the name. That they mean the same thing. D of E and G of E are both the density of states. But it's as if you were filling a, I don't know, maybe a wine glass with particles of sand, and the gravity holds them in, and then there's a layer on the top, and this represents the Fermi energy, the highest energy, just a different way to visualize what's going on. So first, I'm going to take you through the calculation at absolute zero, where the calculations are easier. And Cattell also does this in the book, but he kind of hand waves. He gets the right answer, but he hand waves his way through it. It's not that difficult to do it exactly correctly using statistical mechanics, and so that's what we'll do. All right, so remember, we're looking for a heat capacity CV that's proportional to the temperature for metals. Now, this was a puzzle in the early 20th century, because once it was known that the atoms contain lots of pieces, in particular lots of electrons, the equipartition theorem should tell you, well, there should be 1/2 kBT of energy for every degree of freedom, and if there's a lot of electrons, there should be a lot of degrees of freedom, and the heat capacity should be enormous. But in fact, the heat capacity for metals is very small, and you all know this. If you have a sheet of aluminum foil that has been in the oven and is in equilibrium with the oven maybe at 500 degrees, you can reach in and grab the aluminum foil with your hand and pull it out and you won't get burned. And that's because of the low specific heat of the metal. So if you just put a little bit of energy into a metal, the temperature skyrockets. And conversely, if you take just a little bit of energy out, the temperature drops. Okay, so we want to explain that. And Cattell's version looks something like this. Only the states at the very top of the distribution are available. So for example, you can't excite a state down here on the bottom because all the states above it are filled. And so the only states that are available for you to excite with thermal energy are the ones at the top. And he derives that the internal energy goes like T squared, and therefore the heat capacity, which is du dt, goes like temperature to the first power, but we're going to do it more correctly. Okay, look back at the notes from last time, and we derived that for the electrons in the Drude model or in the Sommerfeld model, follow this formula. The internal energy has a bunch of constants out in front, and then an integral over reciprocal space. So these were these quantum numbers. J vector was jx comma jy jz. We then switched to spherical coordinates. We integrated over the angles, assuming that the distribution was isotropic. And this is the radial part of J. So remember, you really should be calling this R sub J, but that's a little bit cumbersome notation. So just J itself. And we found there were two factors of J coming from the energy. There were another two factors of J coming from the measure in spherical coordinates. And so altogether, four factors of J, which you had to integrate from zero to some largest value J max. Okay, now I want to do it again, but change variables and use energy. Use the energy as the integration variable instead of the radial part of J. And I need an equation to start with. For non-relativistic electrons, the energy is p squared over 2m. And if you translate that into these reciprocal coordinates into J space, it's Planck's constant without a bar squared, J squared over 8m L squared. And L is that macroscopic size of the crystal. It could be centimeters or meters. All right, you can solve this for J, and again, a bunch of constants under the root, and then what's important is that it's proportional to the square root of the energy. Take the derivative of both sides of this equation. On the left, simply dj, and on the right, these constants are unaffected by the derivative. The derivative of epsilon to the 1/2 is 1/2 epsilon to the minus 1/2, and then d epsilon. So now this integral over J space is converted into an integral over energy, and I start at energy zero. Remember, I can't really get there. All the quantum numbers, Jx, Jy, Jz, start at one, not zero. So epsilon equals zero is not accessible, but the energies are so small and so close to zero, and there's so many of them, there's so many levels, that they look like a continuum, and it won't hurt to start at zero instead of some infinitesimally small starting point. And then corresponding to the J max upper endpoint on the first integral, there is an E Fermi energy on the second integral. All right, all of these constants, I will give a name so I don't have to keep copying this collection over and over again. Everything in red square brackets is the density of states. That's G of E. It's what we were calling capital D of E last time. It's also called the degeneracy. It's called the multiplicity. It's the number of states with energy E. Well, actually, the number of states with energy between epsilon and epsilon plus a little tiny increment, D epsilon. All right, and what I find is the integral for the internal energy is an integral from zero to E Fermi of epsilon times G of epsilon d epsilon. So remember that form. And now look at the integral for N. If I want to calculate the number of states, that is, if I want the number of dots in this diagram on the top of the page, that's the same integral, but without the epsilon in here. It's an integral as epsilon starts at zero and goes to E Fermi, and then the density of states, G of epsilon, d epsilon, but no epsilon out in front. So if I do put an epsilon in the integral, like it's shown in the box, then I get the average energy U. And if I do the same integral without the epsilon here, just a factor of one, that gives me the number of particles. Okay, so not too bad for absolute zero temperature. Now we're going to warm the crystal up a little bit, and we're going to look at T non-zero, but small. And what has changed? Well, first, let's calculate N, the number of states. Now, the integral starts at zero, just like it did above here. But instead of ending at E Fermi, we go all the way to infinity. There is still a factor of the density of states, like there was above, G of epsilon. And now I include the Fermi-Dirac distribution that we derived last time, that's given by this denominator here, remember, with a plus sign between the exponential and the one. And I need to integrate all the way to infinity because now there is a non-zero probability of finding a fermion with very large values of epsilon. It's not very likely. The distribution tails off as the energy gets higher, but it's non-zero and I need to integrate all the way out. If this bothers you, I could have integrated over here when we were doing the zero temperature result. I could have integrated this N over epsilon, starting at zero and going out to infinity as well, if I had only included the Fermi-Dirac distribution, this average occupation number n Fermi-Dirac, if I included that in the integral, it wouldn't hurt anything, because for low energies, it would be one, and for energies above the Fermi energy, it would be zero. And so including this factor of n Fermi-Dirac in this integral here would have allowed me to integrate to infinity in the t equals zero case as well. Let's see, now this this is the integral for n, the number of states. There's a similar integral in blue for the internal energy. The only difference between the green integral and the blue integral is this factor of epsilon, factor of energy in the lower integral. And so now I have two. I have this green integral for n, and I have this blue integral for u. Here's a graph of what's going on. There's a typo in the notes, by the way. This is not n, this is dn dE. This should be a differential quantity that I'm plotting vertically versus the energy epsilon. And at t equals zero Kelvin, I get the red curve. This is the density of states, d of e or g of e. And there's a cutoff when I exhaust all the states, when I exhaust all the electrons in the conduction band, the energy cuts off, and that happens at the Fermi energy in red. If I warm the system up to a non-zero absolute temperature, I get the blue curve, and the corners get rounded off, and there's this exponential tail that develops. But there's a conservation of the number of states, so all the states that you removed up here in the green hatch marks wind up down here. So these two green hatched areas are the same, but now I have this exponential tail. That's why I have to integrate all the way to infinity for non-zero temperature. The plan is the following. We're going to look at the integral for n in green, and n is known. I know exactly how many conduction electrons I have if you tell me how big the crystal is. So n is known, and what I want to do is extract the chemical potential, mu, from this integral. It is very difficult to do that. There is no analytic way to invert this and find what mu is. So we have to make some approximations, and on a future homework assignment, you'll do it numerically. You'll do it essentially by guessing. You'll guess a value of mu and see if it gives you the correct value of n. If that's wrong, you change the value of mu and see if you get closer to n, and then keep doing that. Take a different value of mu, get closer to n. Eventually, you'll find the right value of chemical potential mu that gives you the correct given number of states n. Once you know what that mu is, that's the same chemical potential down here in the blue integral for the energy. So you take that mu from the green integral, plug it into the blue integral, and that will tell you the internal energy u, and then we can see what the temperature dependence looks like. Once you know the internal energy as a function of the number of particles and the temperature, then the heat capacity is the partial derivative of the internal energy with respect to temperature, holding the volume of the crystal and the number of electrons in the crystal constant. And I will show you that since u has a term that's proportional to t squared, when you take the derivative, the CV will have a term proportional to t. So that's where we're going. That's what we want. Without any approximations, n is this integral. I just copied it over and I substituted for the density of states. I gave this another symbol and another name. But this is the integral I have to do, starting at epsilon equals zero, going all the way to infinity, square root of epsilon. That's part of that's g zero times square root of epsilon would be g of epsilon, density of states, and then multiplied by the Fermi-Dirac distribution and then integrated over epsilon. All right, integrate by parts. When you do that, you will generate a surface term that must be evaluated between the two endpoints, and then you move the derivative from one term to the other and incur a minus sign in front. So this is the result of integrating epsilon to the 1/2 power, so that square root of epsilon up here integrates to epsilon to the 3/2 power. And then the Fermi-Dirac distribution is V, and so I copy that down here. Now I need to evaluate the product of these two terms between epsilon equals zero and infinity. But at epsilon equals zero, at the lower endpoint, this will vanish because zero to the 3/2 power is zero. And at the upper endpoint, infinity, the Fermi-Dirac distribution will vanish. So to remind you, the Fermi-Dirac distribution is graphed here in red. It starts at 1, it goes through a value 1/2 at mu, and then there's this long exponential tail, but as it goes to infinity, it asymptotes to 0. So at both endpoints of the surface term, the term is equal to 0. So that goes away, and I wind up with minus 2/3 times g naught, that's this collection of symbols on the top of the page, epsilon to the 3/2 power, and now I have to move the derivative from the first term to the second, so I need the derivative of the Fermi-Dirac distribution with respect to epsilon. And that calculation is done down here. So I need to take the derivative of 1 divided by e to the beta, beta remember is 1 over kBT, times the quantity epsilon minus mu plus 1. And so more practice with the chain rule, you get the quantity, the exponential plus 1, raised to the minus 2 power. And then I have to go inside and take the derivative. So the derivative will reproduce the exponential back again. And then you're still not done. You need to go up here and take the derivative of the argument of the exponential with respect to beta, with respect to epsilon. And that brings down a factor of beta. This negative sign is coming from the fact that the original denominator is something raised to the negative 1 power. So that's where that negative 1 comes from. This, therefore, in blue, this is the new n integral that I have to do after integrating by parts. It is much more convenient to change to dimensionless variables. So I will define x to be beta times epsilon minus mu. Let's check that that's right. Beta is 1 over kBT, and kBT is an energy. Epsilon is an energy, and mu is an energy. So beta times epsilon minus mu is dimensionless. Take the derivative of both sides. Mu is a constant, and so the derivative of the left-hand side is just dx. The derivative of the right-hand side is beta epsilon. And then we need to check the limits. The lower limit is epsilon equals zero. That corresponds to x equal minus mu beta, minus the chemical potential times 1 over kBT. And the upper endpoint, when epsilon is equal to infinity, then x is also equal to infinity. So I wind up with the integral on the bottom of the page. I won't point to it because that shadow box appears every time I do that. But I haven't made any approximations. So that's an integral we have to work out for the number of states n. And remember, the left-hand side is known. N is given. What we're trying to do is extract the mu from that. So click on lecture 32 now. And this is an approximation that Arnold Sommerfeld worked out. Now I'll start making approximations. So one approximation is the lower limit of that integral, change it from minus mu b to all the way to minus infinity. And why is that an okay thing to do? Because the integrand goes like e to the x. And when you plug in x equals minus mu b, the integrand is already small. If you extend the integral all the way to minus infinity, you're adding a really tiny part, and it doesn't change the answer very much. So that's a negligible contribution. So, all right, that's one approximation. We're going to do that because it's much easier to evaluate the dimensionless integral over x from minus infinity to plus infinity than from some starting value to some ending value. If the integral extends from minus infinity to plus infinity, we're just going to get a number for that x integral. The second approximation will be, we have an epsilon to the 3/2 power in the integrand, and we're going to perform a Taylor expansion. So expand that epsilon about x equals zero, or in other words, expand around the point where epsilon is equal to mu. So the first term of the Taylor expansion will just be mu to the 3/2 power. The next term will be the derivative of epsilon to the 3/2 power with respect to epsilon, After you take the derivative, set epsilon equal to mu, multiply that by epsilon minus mu and divide by 1 factorial. It turns out that that's not far enough. This term, this second term, the Taylor expansion, the linear term, is actually going to vanish in the integral. So I need one more to get the correction. And the first non-zero correction is this. So I'll take the second derivative of epsilon to the 3/2 power with respect to epsilon, set epsilon equal to mu, chemical potential, multiply by epsilon minus mu squared and divide by 2 factorial. And that you can take more corrections if you want to, but that's as far as I need to go to get the first correction. Okay, that results in these terms down here. When I plug them into the n integral, I get, well, 2/3 times a bunch of constants that I call g naught for short. This is the non-dimensionalized integral. I have e to the x on top, e to the x plus 1 quantity squared on the bottom. And now I've included those three terms above from expanding epsilon to the 3/2. Let's treat them individually. So first look at term number one. Term number one would be 2/3 g naught times mu to the 3/2. Those are all constants, and so I pulled them out. And now I've, instead of using the non-dimensionalized form, I've gone back to the original form. That integrand was the negative derivative of the Fermi-Dirac distribution with respect to epsilon, integrated over epsilon. But I have changed the lower limit. So instead of starting at zero, I start at minus infinity and go all the way to plus infinity. Because it's easier to evaluate in this form, this is an exact derivative. The dE, or d epsilon rather, in the denominator will cancel the d epsilon in the numerator. And so you're integrating an exact derivative. And that just gives you the Fermi-Dirac distribution evaluated at the endpoints. And so when I evaluate this at minus infinity, I get 1. When I evaluate the Fermi-Dirac distribution at plus infinity, I get nothing. So that was a quick way to do the integral. Otherwise, you could just do the integral over x and see what would happen. But this is a shortcut. So the contribution from term number one in the n integral is just 2/3 g naught mu to the 3/2 power. And if you substitute what g naught is and clean things up, you'll find that n is equal to mu naught divided by E Fermi, all that quantity to the 3/2 power. Later on, we're going to find that this reproduces exactly the zero Kelvin result. This is the absolute zero result. And as I told you, the next term in the Taylor expansion is going to vanish. So it's the third term that's the correction. All right, let's look at term number two. Term number two is proportional to this. So now I've gone to the dimensionless integral again. I have an integral over x from minus infinity to plus infinity, e to the x times x in the numerator, e to the x plus 1 quantity squared in the denominator integrated over dx. It's not easy to see in that form that this integral is odd in x and is therefore zero. So to make it more clear, multiply top and bottom by e to the negative x. On the top, that will cancel this term. So there's just a factor of x by itself in the numerator now. And in the bottom, one of these parenthetical expressions is e to the x plus 1. The other will be 1 plus e to the minus x when you multiply through by e to the minus x. So I get e to the x plus 1 times 1 plus e to the minus x. And now it's clear the denominator is even. If you exchange x for minus x, the denominator doesn't change, but the numerator does. So the denominator is even, the numerator is odd, the integral is therefore odd. And integrating an odd integral over the entire range from minus infinity to plus infinity gets zero. Now the third term, the most important one, that's proportional to an integral over x from minus infinity to plus infinity, e to the x times x squared, e to the x plus 1 quantity squared. And this is a numerical constant. It happens to be pi squared over 3. So that's just a number. And now if I summarize the results so far, we started with an integral for n. Let me scroll up a little bit. to find it. This, we started with an integral in blue to find n on the left-hand side. So that's still n. The first term we got from the zeroth approximation in the Taylor expansion was n times mu over E Fermi to the 3/2 power. The second term vanished. And now the third term, so everything we just did integrating over x produced this factor of pi squared over 3. The other terms came from changing variables. I had to change variables twice. That is to say there are two factors of x, so that generates two factors of kbt. And g naught is a collection of factors that's further up in the notes that you can look up and substitute. And so this is what I get. Now there's an n in every term, so you can cancel the n from all the terms. And I want to solve this for the chemical potential mu. So the first thing to do is get this term by itself on the left-hand side. Here it is, mu over epsilon to the 3/2 power. When I cancel the n, there's a 1 on the left-hand side. And then I will subtract this. And because I'm solving for mu, this term is already small. This is a correction. This term is already small, and so it doesn't hurt to replace this mu in the correction term by E Fermi. Mu and E Fermi are very close if the temperature is close to, but very slightly above absolute zero. So in the second term, set mu equal to E Fermi. And now it's just algebra to solve for this mu on the left-hand side. So raise both sides to the 2/3 power. That will cancel this exponent here. And now I have 1 plus a small quantity raised to the 2/3 power. And so use the binomial expansion. Again, keeping the constant term and the lowest order correction term. And I find that mu over E Fermi is 1 minus pi squared over 12. And then the quantity kBT over E Fermi squared. All right. You should look at this carefully yourself and make sure that every line makes sense, because we're about to do it again. I won't drag you through the details this time. The same thing we just did for the n integral, you're going to do for the u integral. Remember, the only difference between the n integral and the u integral is this extra factor of epsilon energy in the integrand. And so now, where I previously had epsilon to the 1/2 power, now I have epsilon to the 3/2 power. You do the same thing, you integrate by parts. The surface term vanishes at both the lower and the upper limits, so you can forget about that. The integrated term looks the same as they did before, except instead of 2/3 out in front, there's 2/5, and instead of epsilon to the 3/2, there's an epsilon to the 5/2, and do exactly what we did for the integral. Expand epsilon to the 5/2 power about epsilon equals mu. So without reading this to you, that's what you need to do. The results are given on this line. And again, you generate three integrals. The first one is going to reproduce the t equals zero Kelvin result. The second one is going to vanish, just like it did in the n integral, because that integral turns out to be odd. And the last one will give you some non-zero number. Okay, so a little bit of work for you to do at home. Here are the answers. Actually, let's switch to lecture 33 now, because they have all three of the terms. So term number one integrates to 3/2 n times the ratio of mu to the 5/2 to the Fermi energy to the 3/2 power. The second integral vanishes. And the third one gives you constants out in front, kBT quantity squared. That's important because we want that t squared dependence in u. And then there is a dimensionless integral over x, which happens to be the same one as it was before, and it works out to be pi squared over 3. All right. When I put everything together, I find that in this Sommerfeld approximation for u, I wind up with these three terms. The first and third term involve the chemical potential. And remember, we had to solve the n equation to figure out what mu was, but we did that. So to lowest order, the chemical potential is the Fermi energy minus pi squared over 12 kBT quantity squared over the Fermi epsilon. So take this mu and plug it in here in the first term, and plug it in here in the second term, and keep only terms of order t squared. So don't worry, we're almost done. The zeroth order term is this, 3/5 n e Fermi. That should look familiar. That was what we got for the internal energy for degenerate Fermi gas, that is to say cold or at absolute zero. So as promised, the leading order terms are reproducing the t equals zero result. The first order corrections for both n and u vanished, and so the second order t squared corrections for u give you this factor. It is positive, so the energy is a little bit higher than it would be at absolute zero. And importantly, it goes like temperature squared, t squared. So now the heat capacity, finally, is the derivative of this internal energy u with respect to t, holding the volume and the number of particles fixed. And sure enough, when you take the derivative, the constant term will drop out, and you'll get a collection of terms that is proportional to t. So we have derived, without hand waving, we've derived the linear dependence of the heat capacity for electrons in a crystal. And that's as far as we need to go. So now we're done.